Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I am your host, Matt Salmon, and as always, glad to have you along for the classic cardboard conversation. And I appreciate your patience and your understanding. We certainly needed a lot of patience and understanding a couple of weeks ago as my family made the cross-country move. I am now living in Arizona time in Phoenix, and it's been pretty good. I'll share some stories with you about that in a little bit. But I appreciate your patience and understanding not doing our show a couple weeks ago, July 2nd. Normally we'd come your way every Friday, but that was not the case. Just would have been way too much for me to try to wedge in a podcast on top of all the other things that I was doing. So I really appreciate you understanding. But something really good has come out of that pause. And I think this could be said for anyone who moves from one location to another, not necessarily cross-country like I did, but even if you're just cross-town, you know, you're going 20 miles the other direction or whatever, one of the good things about relocation is experiencing new things. So perhaps a new climate, new job, new home, new neighborhood, new schools, new leisure activities, fun things to do. But for collectors, the greatest thing about the newness of a relocation is checking out new card shops. And I have found several in the Phoenix area. Pleasantly surprised, you know, living in Tampa for so many years, there were only a handful of shops, some much better than others. Most of my business I would do at a card show that happened every month. But looking at the shops here in the Phoenix area, there's quite a few to choose from, and I've only hit up one. I'm going to hit up a couple of others sometime within the next few weeks, but the one I went to didn't quite live up to my expectations. It got good reviews online, but, you know, I went in looking for a certain thing, mostly 75, 76, 77 tops cards to, you know, complete the set, and I wasn't able to do that. The guy very brusquely said, "Nah, we don't have that." But, you know, I was in the shop with my son, and I said, "All right, well, we'll just look around." So, you know, went through the bargain boxes, found a couple of singles that I liked. He found several cards that he liked. So, you know, we spent like $10 on 12, 14 cards, whatever. But as many shops do, the shop had the same thing, and that is the bargain bin for packs. And I love fishing through the bargain bin for packs because, well, it's kind of like, you know, Forrest Gump. You never know what you're going to get. And I went fishing through this guy's boxes of packs, and you had the usual suspects, plenty of 91 Donruss, quite a few 89 tops, some non-sports stuff, you know, some Desert Storm things from the early 90s. But then when you dug a little deeper, found some minor league packs. Okay, that's interesting. But then I found some packs of sets that I had had an eye on eBay. And I'm so glad that I found these packs at the store because depending on the pack, they were either 50 cents or a dollar a piece. Whereas eBay, because of shipping and everything, you know, to get two or three packs, it would have been like $10. So I saved some money there. But I found a few packs that we'll incorporate in future shows, including 93 Fleer, which is a set that I very lightly collected back in 1993. And that's mostly because of just all the other products that were out there. I just didn't get around to Fleer, even though Fleer put out a decent set in 93. There is also the Pacific brand from 1989-90, the Senior Professional Baseball League. This was a league that was based in Florida. The president of the league was the late Kurt Flood, and it was basically a league for retirees. You know, a lot of players end up retiring in Florida because they spring train there, so they like it there, so they just move down there for good. And back in the late 80s, they created the Senior Professional Baseball League, which was, you know, retired players, and there were, I think, six or eight teams. One that I recall that was in St. Petersburg, near where I grew up, the St. Pete Pelicans. I don't recall much about the league other than the fact it was there and it only lasted a year. But there was a card set for those. So I picked up a couple of those packs. I think that would be a pretty fun, unique look at a very unique league that was only around for 1 year. Like I said, the winter of 1989, and that was it. And we'll be taking a look at those. But I also picked up a couple of packs that, again, I have my eye on eBay. And it is the subject of this week's program. Now, we're not just going to talk about this one particular set, but give you a little window on the history of the company. And that history would be on OPG, the brand that I have often teased. It is the redheaded stepchild of the baseball card industry in the States. Because even though OPG put out very good sets on the baseball side, because it wasn't Topps and because the sets were numbered different, they were skewed to print more Canadian-based teams, a lot of collectors in the States didn't like him. And I've often likened the idea of getting an OPG card, it's very similar to when you put in, back in the day, it was only 50 cents for a can of Coke, right? Well, remember the outrage when they raised the price to like 60 cents or 65 cents. Well, nobody carries 65 cents in their pocket. So you would have 3/4 and you would drop it in the Coke machine and it would spit out your change. So you either had the the dime or a couple of nickels that came out. But, you know, the ignominy when the dime gets spit out and it's not an American dime, it's a Canadian dime. Because you're looking at it, it's like, well, you know, I could pass this by some people, they wouldn't notice. But at the same time, it's like, well, this isn't even worth 10 cents. You know, the exchange rate, it's worth maybe 7 or 8. So there's always that kind of chagrin, you know, oh, I got the Canadian nickel, but it's only worth 4 cents, not 5. Or the Canadian quarter, because the Canadian quarters are about the same size as American quarters. And you go, all right, well, this is only worth 20 cents, not 25. That was kind of the same thing with OPG for many, many years. Yes, the card looked like Topps, smelled like Topps. The biggest difference, of course, was the bilingual text on the back starting in the early 70s, and that was a Canadian government mandate. So, you know, it was kind of neat to see French and English on the back, but whenever you got those cards, you kind of felt like you were getting gypped. And that's no offense to the great country of Canada or to OPG or the people who did like collecting it. It just felt like you were getting shortchanged a little bit. But there's a very interesting history with OPG. In fact, it actually started selling baseball cards before Topps did, back in the early 1930s. So we're going to have a little bit of a history on that. We'll talk in particular about the 1992 Premier set, which was the second year of Premier. So it really wasn't a Premier. Premier was being used as an adjective. You know, it was a kind of a premium set as opposed to a debut. I guess it would be the noun version of Premier. But it actually got its start in hockey in 1991, was wildly successful with hockey, and then came over to baseball later in the 1991 season. Was not as widely accepted, although the 1992 set much better than the 91 set. And something that you've seen a common theme in some of the sets that we've talked about recently, and it is definitely the case with 1991 OPG Premier. This is a great set, not just because of design, but also because of star power and some young stars, rookies. And it's very easy to collect because, first of all, it's a shorter press run. It's under 400 cards. But also because it is, again, mostly kicked to the curb in the States. Very few people are, you know, jumping for joy over OPG cards. A lot of people just, you know, kind of ignored them. So There are still quite a few sets that are out there, quite a few cards that are out there. And because there's a general, I don't want to say a lack of interest, but just not this big desire to go after this particular set. And there really wasn't almost 30 years ago. But because it's just kind of one of those sets that got pushed off to the side, not all that different from Donruss Triple Play, which we've talked about. There is a little bit of supply that is out there. It is very affordable. Like I said, it's easy to collect because there's fewer cards in the total set. And I think this is something where if you were to invest, say, $30 or $40, you know, go pulling around some packs and some boxes, you can probably assemble a set very easily and be very happy with what you get. In fact, in our pack break, which is on the new YouTube channel, please subscribe to that at Wax Ecstatic if you haven't done so already. You're going to see some of the star power that's in there. One pack we pulled, I think in this order, we had what? Daryl Strawberry, Frank Thomas, Ken Griffey Jr., Tony Gwynn, and then Phil Plantier came in and kind of brought the room down a bit. But, you know, you had four hits in a row here. And as is the case with any junk wax set, you're not going to get a ton of money for these. And you shouldn't be collecting the set in the hopes of making money. But, you know, still, it's pretty impressive when you can go one card after the other. And you're pulling guys like Thomas and Griffey and Gwynn all in a row. I mean, just imagine actually opening that pack in 1992. You would have fainted. Because those cards back then, right out of the pack, would have been, you know, $2-3 a pop. At least the Griffey and the Thomas. You know, the Gwynn probably would have been closer to a dollar. But even the speculation on a Phil Plantier might have gotten you a dollar. And, you know, whatever you bought for retail price, probably $1.99 back then. And you only got 8 cards in the pack. But, you know, if you spent a couple bucks on the pack, you certainly made up for it with some of those star cards that came out. So, you know, some very interesting cards and some stars that you can pull out there. And like I said, it's very similar to Donruss Triple Play, which we recently discussed, where it's a smaller set, it's loaded with stars, it's got a great design, and it's relatively easy to get these days because it was kind of swamped by all the other cards that were being made back then. So some of the you know, pushing off to the side that a lot of collectors did back then, it could benefit you now if you're looking for a set that is just fun and relatively quick and easy to put together. And if that's the case, then this is definitely a set that you'll want to take a look at. So we'll be talking OPG, and in particular, 1992 OPG Premier on this episode. As I mentioned in future episodes, we will revisit 1993 Fleer. We'll take a look at the Pacific Senior Professional Baseball League cards as well. Still trying to work my angles at Beckett, the people at the Beckett Monthly, although it's not monthly anymore, but the Beckett Price Guide folks, just to give us a little fun history behind the Beckett Monthly Price Guides, which we used to eagerly await by the mailbox for every month. Once you got the Beckett in there, you know, you'd spend a couple of hours combing through it and checking the values of several of your favorite cards. I know that for a fact. So we're still working on that. And as I mentioned in the last program as well, we did the recent circling back on some sets that we just, you know, did one show on and moved on from. We're going to do the same thing by decades. We're going to do one set from the 1950s, one from the 1960s, and one from the 1970s. So again, the caveat is sets that we have not done a second look on. So for example, from the 70s, we've already done two shows on 75 tops and 74 and 77 and 78. So, you know, we're going to check those off there. You know, this isn't a survey of what's the best set from the decades. This is just as we go through the archives and we go, yeah, we only talked about this set one time. This is our chance to kind of go back and take a second look at them. So keep an eye out for those survey questions. We'll post them within the next few days on our Twitter timeline at Wax and Gum Stains. And we will pepper in those shows as well. So we've kind of got the whole spectrum covered there don't we? And again, we'll be working on not just a Beckett interview, somebody from their PR department, I'm sure, but also we'll be looking to explore interviews with other people who have, some kind of important niche within the hobby or even in the sport. And I'll also be pulling together, some baseball-based books that I'll be adding to my book queue. And that'll be fun, too, because there's one in particular. I'm not going to say much about it, but there's one in particular I want to read based on a player who we pulled his card from a pack maybe about 2 years ago, and he was one of the random selections from the pack, and he had such a very interesting story, which has been turned into a book. So we'll start reaching out for that as well, on top of again all the sets. We'll do one from the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, and then we've got the senior professional league packs from 1990, the 93 Fleer as well. So not in any particular order, but that'll kind of give you an idea, a little bit of a roadmap of some of the programs that we're working on over the next few months. Also working over the next few months, the waxandgumstains.com website. I've been promoting this. This is kind of like the big dig. We keep saying it's going to get done one of these days, and it will. Now that I've moved, now that I've relocated, now that I have accounted for everything that we packed up, we are finally going to spend some time. In fact, I'm going to devote some time later this month and early August before things get a little crazy for me at work and with school too. We will work on getting that website up and running. So I'm not going to push the SurveyMonkey survey anymore. It's still in our bio on Twitter if you wish to respond to it, but I think we've gotten as many responses as possible that we get out of it. I'll be pulling together a little bit of a roadmap for the website, and we're going to make that a nice little compliment to our podcast too. So some of the things that we discuss either in greater detail or maybe things that we don't discuss much, such as non-baseball cards or other trends in the business or a store locator, things like that, we'll leave for the website. So it's a little less commercial messaging here and a little more just additional content, not only on the podcast, but on the website as well. We'll also provide links if you want to provide any kind of donations, cash or cardboard, to the program. That'll be on the website as well. So I promise you it's getting done. We're getting closer. Still in the planning stages, but now that we've kind of settled in here in our new home in Arizona, we'll have a little more time to dive into that online. But again, one of the good things about the move is getting to explore new card shops. And while I wasn't overly impressed with the one card shop I went to with my son just a few days ago, I was able to grab some of those vintage packs, including, a few sets that I've been keeping an eye on online, including 1992 OPG Premier. And it reminded me of a set that is quite frankly overlooked a lot. It's kind of a shame because it's a good set, but it's also overlooked a lot because, in 1991, when it made its premiere, when Premier made its premiere in 1991, it was a set that started in the hockey realm and was extremely popular, extremely successful with hockey collectors. But by the time it crossed over into baseball, it was not as popular for various reasons, which we'll get into. But by 1992, they had certainly ironed out the wrinkles in the set, and they produced a very sharp set that's loaded with a lot of star players and is pretty affordable. It's pretty easy to get your hands on that nowadays if you're looking for a fun set to collect. And it was a big departure for OPG in the early 1990s to branch out and basically create an identity separate from Topps. But it was not completely unheard of because Leaf, who of course was the parent company of Donruss, had done the exact same thing starting in 1990. You had the Leaf base set, and then you had Leaf Studio, and all of a sudden the Leaf brand became the premium brand. Well, in the end for OPG, OPG was not a premium brand, but it was certainly an upscale base set. You know, in the Topps relationship, Stadium Club was definitely the premium brand. And as the years would go by, Topps Finest would come around, and there were other subsets that branched out of that. But for OPG, it was a very big change considering what had started the company in the first place. Now, much like every other baseball card producer in the early 20th century, OPG started as a candy company. It was a Canadian candy company that was based in London, Ontario. Started in 1911. And it was primarily a bubblegum producer, but they also made several other candies. And the company was started by brothers John McKinnon McDermott, known as J.K. McDermott, and Duncan Hugh, D.H. McDermott. And as time went on, they started putting out little tchotchkes that went with the candy to help promote the candy or to help sell the candy. And starting in the early 1930s, they got into the trading card business. And when you look at some of the OPG cards from the early 1930s, they're actually pretty decent productions. You know, there were some cards that were made around that time that were, I don't want to say shoddy, but certainly product quality was not the first thing top of mind here. It was just a promotional vessel for the candy or gum that was being sold. But with OPG, starting in 1934, the OPG V94, or as they call it, the 1934 Canadian Butterfinger, is recognized as the first diamond set for OPG. And you look at the 1934 cards, and basically they're just black and white photos, mostly posed photos, but they featured a facsimile autograph on the front. And with 58 players in the set, you had some pretty big stars that were in there, including Lou Gehrig, also Babe Ruth, and Jimmy Fox as well. Now, this is notable because while this was happening as other competitors or future competitors, I should say, such as Topps and Bowman were creating their own bubblegum and their own candies, and in some cases trading cards, OPG was definitely ahead of the curve here, creating baseball cards before Topps really even got into the conversation. And again, before Bowman really got into it here. Now, it wasn't a regular card set, however. This was a one-off almost in 1934, but they would come back in 1937 with the V300, very similar to the Gaudi baseball cards of 1934-1935. There's a little bit of a cartoon element along with action shots of the players. And what's interesting about the 1937 cards is they had a pop-up element to it. So a thing that you would see with baseball cards in the 1980s, kind of a neat little niche side like the Donruss All-Star pop-ups, OPG was doing it back in 1937. There was also a player bio on the back that was bilingual. This was before it was Canadian law that you have to have French and English on there. And again, a pretty solid checklist here. A 40-card set featuring Hank Greenberg, also a young Bob Feller, and a young Joe DiMaggio. So if you look at just some screenshots of some of these cards, pretty impressive, not color. They're all black and white. But just the idea that OPG didn't just make a card. You know, think of the old tobacco cards where it was just a picture of a player. But they made a card that was, for 1937 standards, interactive. You were able to pop it up. You had these players would be bigger, larger than life, if you will, as they, you know, kind of rose from the surface of the cardboard. And you had this very mid-1930s contemporary style of art and that cartoon in the background. So you're thinking that OPG is going to have something here that would be a regular piece of their marketing, but they didn't do it after 1937. And the only reason, I can't find a definitive reason for this, but the only reason that I can think of is that the world, including Canada, but especially in North America, the world was just in the throes of the Great Depression. So So even though, they were putting out sets of baseball cards in 1934 and 1937, they also had some hockey sets going on at that time. There just wasn't a big momentum to create anything on a regular basis. And they would continue to make hockey sets and some one-off sets here and there, but it didn't become any kind of regular promotion at this point in time. And it wouldn't until the late 1950s. In 1958, OPG entered a marketing agreement with Topps, and OPG was making sets that were primarily sold in Canada. So you're looking at Canadian Football League, also NHL cards, as well as OPG was going head-to-head with Parkhurst, which was another big brand of hockey cards at that time. And as they're starting to build a base of hockey fans for the most part in the 1960s, Topps decides to grow their brand by teaming up with OPG. And this is what most collectors remember about OPG, basically mirroring Topps sets. And that started in 1965, where OPG produced a set that was either a complete reproduction of the Topps set or it was a partial reproduction of a top set, where it was marketed and sold primarily in Canada, although occasionally you would find OPG packs and sets being made available in America. Now, there were some notable differences in the OPG cards compared to the Topps cards. While the sets typically looked alike, they had the same design. Of course, the biggest change was you didn't have the Topps brand on there. Whenever Topps did include a logo, it would be replaced by a very simple OPG logo. And then on top of that, you did have the bilingual biographies and positions and stuff like that. That became standard starting in 1970, again, with the Canadian law pushing that you had to have French and English writing translations on everything. So, that was a neat thing. But also, OPG often, not always, but often had a different kind of card stock, in many ways a better card stock, the thick white card stock, as opposed to the gray stock that Topps was quite familiar with for many of the years, especially in the 1970s. After they moved on from the white card stock in 1970, going back to the gray primarily through 1991, going with that gray card stock. So you had the language, you had the branding, you had the card stock. But then the other noticeable changes, once Canada got a baseball team, the Montreal Expos in 1969, the OPG sets, which were typically smaller than the top sets, would feature a little bit more emphasis on Canadian teams. So the Expos in 1969 and then the Toronto Blue Jays in 1977. And that would allow for some early premier cards, if you will. A great example is Delino DeShields. In 1988, Delino DeShields was a Montreal Expos prospect. He was featured in the OPG set in 1988. Was not part of the Topps base set. I believe it was part of Topps traded in 1988. But the infamous Delino DeShields card for OPG in 1988, featuring a very large and puffy Montreal Expos hat, an airbrushed hat, as OPG rushed a picture of DeShields to get him into their base set in 1988. Also, Derek Bell was a draft pick for the Blue Jays, so he had a rookie card in OPG. Easy for me to say. He had a rookie card in OPG, but not in the top sets. In fact, both guys would not appear in the base sets for Topps until a couple of years later. Now, OPG, because it was released a little later in the season as well, in many ways, OPG was a little bit of an early version of a traded set. Players who were traded very late in the winter, or maybe they signed as a free agent early in a spring before spring training, could often be included in an OPG base set. At the very least, a mention that the trade has happened. A good example of that Al Downing was with the Milwaukee Brewers, but later signs with the LA Dodgers after a trade. So the OPG card for Al Downing in 1971 features him in a Brewers uniform, but says in very small text in the corner, "Now with Dodgers." And there would often be some mention of a trade or a contract signing on the back in the player bio section. A more recent version of that would be Reggie Jackson. After the 1986 season, Jackson returning to the Oakland Athletics for what would turn out to be his final season in the major leagues in 1987. Well, if you get the 87 Topps card for Jackson, it's him with the California Angels. But the OPG card features Jackson, yes, wearing an Angels uniform. In fact, it's the exact same picture that you see in the Topps set. But the A's logo and the green background in the name box is featured on the 87 OPG card. So it's almost the same as what you would see with 87 Topps, but definitely referencing Jackson signing with the Oakland A's. And again, very small text kind of in the background of the picture. It would say, "Now with A's." And that's something OPG even did with hockey cards, even going back as far as the 1970s. If there was a trade or a late contract signing, there would be the player featured in his old uniform, or maybe the old uniform was airbrushed out, but there would be some text mention of him being on a new team. So that was the biggest difference. So while in many ways, and I joke about this, how OPG was the redheaded stepchild of Topps because it mirrored Topps for so many years, in many cases, there were enough differences to where OPG was separate and independent from Topps. The typically smaller set size, the different card stock, the French and English text that was on there, the quote-unquote early traded set featuring players that at least had a mention on their card that they had been traded to a different team or they had signed with a different team. And then, again, some early premier cards, Delino DeShields, Derek Bell, some examples from the late 1980s. So even though there were a lot of differences with the Canadian set, a lot of American collectors didn't really appreciate the differences. Granted, the set was never really marketed to them in the first place. So, you know, American collectors would obviously focus more on the Topps set. And then as other competitors came around in the 1980s from Donruss and Fleer, and of course later Score and Upper Deck, then, you know, collectors really, in America at least, really didn't pay any attention to OPG. In fact, if you got an OPG card or you found an OPG pack, it was just kind of a neat little quirk to open up, although sometimes it could be a fly in the ointment. How many times has this happened where you're trying to complete a set and you got a stack of cards and they look like Topps cards and you're trying to complete a Topps set, but oops, it's a handful of OPG cards, and you're like, ugh. And they kind of act as placeholders in many cases. That is, if the OPG card number corresponded with the Topps card number. Sometimes it didn't. Very much like the Topps Burger King sets, you know, it's very easy for those to accidentally get slotted into your late 70s and early 80s sets that you may be hand collating. But it, again, because of the Canadian exchange and because they were close but not quite the same thing as the Topps cards, you kind of thumbed your nose at them. And that's something that really became a trend with American collectors, especially in the late 80s going into the early 90s. Well, of course, the hobby is exploding in the early 1990s. Everyone's creating offshoots of base sets and premium sets. And with Leaf kind of taking the first step and creating a premium set under the home brand, OPG would do the same thing in 1991. Now, as I mentioned, OPG was the preferred card for hockey collectors in all of North America, but especially in Canada. OPG was Canada's brand, and they often, throughout the 1960s and 70s, and even into the early 1980s, they would produce the preferred favorite brand of hockey cards. Topps would create a mirror set, but you know, for Topps, hockey was not as big of a deal as, say, baseball or football was at the time. So the OPG brand is solid, not just in Canada, but for anybody who's collecting hockey cards in the early 1990s. Now, there wasn't a whole lot of competition on the hockey side. In fact, Topps slash OPG pretty much cornering the market going into 1990, but then two competitors come around. One was a very minor competitor, and that would be ProSet. Of course, ProSet having football cards at the same time, putting a little dent into the market share for Topps in 1989 and 1990. And they tried to do the same thing in hockey. Now, ProSet created way too many cards, as was the case for many manufacturers, but they created way too many hockey cards. So there was a very lackluster acceptance of ProSet in 1990, 91, 92. Meanwhile, the other competitor was one that Topps and OPG had to take note of, and that was Upper Deck. Upper Deck started expanding its footprint rather rapidly. You may recall once they made their baseball debut in 1989, very quickly adding football and basketball and hockey and also minor league sports in the early 1990s. Now, when I say early 1990s, I mean like 1990 to 92, very quickly growing that footprint and really threatening the corner hold that the Topps and OPG partnership had in hockey. So OPG decides to branch out and create the Premier brand in 1991-92, and it is very well received by hockey fans. First of all, because it was a nice change from the standard base OPG set, which again Topps would often mirror, but also it was better than what ProSet was putting out, and it was on par with what you had from Upper Deck. So the people at OPG are thinking, hey, we've got a winner here with hockey, let's copy that with baseball. And it's so funny how OPG and Topps are so intertwined with one another, because Topps was doing the exact same thing, but on the flip side with baseball. The Topps set in 1991 for baseball was such a smashing success that they said, hey, let's just copy this design for football and basketball and hockey. And they would do a very similar thing in 1992. You know, there wasn't a lot of creativity or differentiation between baseball and all the other sports that Topps was marketing at that time. So while Topps was taking their baseball brand and design and basically just stamping that into different sports, OPG was taking their hockey brand and design and trying to stamp that onto baseball as well. Well, the 1991 set, even though it had a nice clean look to it, it was very bland, very boring, not all that different from Fleer Ultra in 1991. It was like a good effort, a good idea, but it just didn't quite translate into a very popular set. And think of what the baseball card scene was in 1991. You had base sets such as Topps and Upper Deck that were outstanding. You had the emergence of premium sets. You know, Leaf was great. Stadium Club makes its debut. Leaf Studio is starting to grab people's attention. So it wasn't just good enough to have a base set that was good enough. It had to be great. And Premier kind of fell short on those expectations. Well, in 1992, they tweaked things just a little bit, and the overall look looks like a very gussied up Topps set. And what I mean by that is there are some similarities with the white border and typically action shots on the front. Now, the Topps baseball set in 1992 had stadium shots on the back. OPG actually had mug shots of players on the back. But some similarities there, but also just a little bit of differentiation from what everybody else was putting out back then. OPG going with the one season, you know, previous season and career stats lines, going with a large full-color photograph on the back. There is a lot of wasted space on the back of the cards, with a team logo and the 92 OPG premium logo as well. That's something that they could have done better. But a lot of other 1992 looks, including color gradients from this light yellow gold color that kind of bleeds into a dark green by the time you get to the bottom of the stats box. Only 198 cards in the set. That's ridiculously easy to put together. Plus, you can put it in one of those tiny little 200 card boxes. So not all that difficult to hand collate. You can just get several packs or a box And you may even end up, if you're lucky, depending on how many dupes you get, you might even get a couple of sets out of it to wow your friends and neighbors with all those extra Junk Wax cards from that time. Now, even though the 1992 set was an outstanding effort, OPG cards would continue for a few more years, but they would get swallowed up in the watering down of the whole industry. And also, despite a pretty good set that was released in 1994, not only the oversaturated baseball card market, but OPG suffered a double whammy in terms of interest in their cards, because 1994, of course, not only the year of the baseball strike and the World Series cancellation, but if you're a hockey fan, you'll remember there was a very lengthy lockout to the start of the 1994-95 season. So basically from August 12th, 1994 to roughly January 20th, 1995, the two main products that OPG was making, there was nothing to promote it with. There were no sports. There was no baseball from August 12th through the end of what would have been the 1994 World Series. There was no hockey season from early October through January 20th of the 94-95 season. So that turns out to be pretty much a death knell for the OPG cards at that time. Now, even though Topps would bring back OPG's brand in hockey and basketball later on in the decade, the interest for the OPG brand, again, as well as the entire hobby, just completely collapsed. Well, it would come back, however, in the early 2000s, as Upper Deck was able to purchase the OPG name in 2006. Now, Upper Deck decides to revitalize and bring back to life the OPG hockey cards, as well as mirroring their Upper Deck brand of hockey cards at that time. And they decide to wade into baseball one more time. So you had retro style inserts in Upper Deck baseball in 2008 featuring the OPG brand, and they would do the same thing in 2009. Now, at the same time, Upper Deck would get into some trouble with the Topps company, because if you tried to make a retro style insert, well, that also means you're going to steal some retro style designs. Well, that's intellectual property of Topps. So Topps sues Upper Deck, and ultimately they settle in court, but Upper Deck had to avoid using any old Topps or OPG designs if they were going to release an OPG card. Now, after Upper Deck lost the license to create baseball cards, thanks to the MLB and MLBPA signing an exclusive deal with Topps in 2010, the OPG brand stuck with hockey. But as it turns out, with baseball, that was pretty much it for OPG. So a very interesting long and winding road for OPG. And as for the 92 OPG Premier, it is a bargain bin beauty. I picked mine up just a couple of packs. You only get 8 cards in a pack for 50 cents. So if you're on the lookout for a sharp set loaded with stars, loaded with young stars, future Hall of Famers, that won't put a crimp in your wallet or bank account, OPG is definitely, or OPG Premier, I should say, just to qualify it, OPG Premier is definitely a set that you would want to look at, because it offers up those qualities plus a great quantity of cards that other sets, you know, they have. But because of the interest in the hobby now, you know, it's a little harder to get a 92 Topps or even, you know, 92 Fleer or Donruss. The prices have gone up just a little bit as collectors and investors try to hunt out those two or three key cards from each set. OPG, much like it was in the 1990s, much like it was for many decades before in America, it still is now, just kind of off to the side. But a neat set to collect. And again, if you've got maybe 30 or 40 bucks and you want to hand collate it, go for it. It's kind of fun to look through some of these names and some of the unique differences between OPG and Topps in 1992. And even some just interesting things, you know, like we noticed the first card I pulled out of the pack was an Ozzie Smith card. Well, when you flip it over on the back, OPC didn't use the standard St. Louis Cardinals logos of 1992. It was the centennial anniversary of the Cardinals, and they used an alternate logo on the back of the card, which I thought was neat. So there's lots of interesting little surprises in the 1992 OPC Premier set. All right, let's get to the bottom of the order as we take a look at three cards that were randomly pulled from these packs. And of course, when you get packs with so many Hall of Famers or well-known names, or we've covered a lot of Junk Wax packs, you end up with a lot of people you've already talked about. So I've, out of the 16 cards, you know, moved past the Hall of Famers and the big names and the guys we've talked about before. And I think we found three that we have not discussed. They are, in order, Mike Bordick, Doug Drabek, and Dan Gladden. So let's start off with Mike Bordick, who I totally forgot how solid of a ball player Mike Bordick was. And I mentioned during the video that he was supposed to be the heir apparent to the shortstop position in Oakland, following Walt Weiss, who had a pretty solid time in Oakland before he moved on to different teams. But Bordick not only was a very, very good replacement for Walt Weiss and was a very serviceable middle infielder for the Oakland A's for several years, but I had totally forgotten that he was the guy who replaced Cal Ripken Jr. at shortstop in Baltimore. Not when the streak ended. Of course, Ripken just moved over to third base. It was seen as he was getting a little older to be a better position for him to play. But Bordick did that, and well, I think I'm getting a little ahead of myself here. So let's back it up just a little bit. A native of Marquette, Michigan, however, an Air Force brat, so his family moved all over the place. But his family eventually settled down in Maine, where he starred in high school and baseball, attending Hampton Academy in Hampton, Maine. One of his classmates, Ricky Craven, longtime NASCAR driver. And Bordick was a big star for the Hampton, Maine, Hampton Academy, I should say, in Hampton, Maine. Big star for their program. In fact, the baseball field is actually named in his honor. Well, he signed on with the University of Maine and was able to participate in a lot of College World Series games with them. Maine had a lot of outstanding teams throughout the 1980s, had some very deep tournament runs for many, many years. And you would think with all the exposure, even though the College World Series in the mid-1980s, not quite as exposed as the College World Series is now, you would think with all that extra exposure, it would have led to Bordick getting drafted. But it didn't, surprisingly. He was an undrafted ball player in the summer of 1986 when he thought he would get signed. Well, it turns out, after playing Cape Cod baseball with Yarmouth, one of his teammates, by the way, Jeff Bagwell, so he's in association with some good people in the Northeast. Well, he does get the attention of a scout for the Oakland Athletics, J.P. Ricciardi. Remember that name, former GM for the Toronto Blue Jays later on in his career. The A's looking for some help up the middle. Ricciardi comes up to Bordick and says, hey, are you willing to sign? And Bordick's like, absolutely. And for Bordick, it was a godsend because the A's at the time in the mid-1980s had one of the best systems bottom to top in the major leagues. And of course, it showed with some of the teams that they were able to produce in the late 80s and early 1990s. So he signs as an amateur free agent in July of 1986, has a couple of brief appearances throughout the 1990 season, but is, going back and forth between AAA and the major leagues. Going into the playoffs in 1990, Bordick wants to spend a little time working on his hitting game. So he asks the A's, hey, can I go to the Arizona Fall League and work on my game? And the A's are like, yeah, sure, absolutely. Well, as it turns out, the A's would need Bordick much sooner than next season because during the American League Championship Series, they suffer some injuries along the way. Mike Gallego gets hurt. Walt Weiss, again, holding things down at shortstop. And he goes down to the Arizona Fall League, and it was Weiss who actually got hurt, not Gallego, but Weiss gets hurt. the A's need an infielder. So in the middle of the World Series, they call him up from the Fall League and say, hey, get here and get playing for us. And he makes his World Series debut as a pinch runner and a defensive replacement and, you know, basically just gets sucked right into a game. Tony La Russa is telling him, hey, be ready. Ron Hassey is, you know, pinch hitting here and you're going to be the pinch runner. So all of a sudden, Hassey gets on base. And Bordick gets into the game, and you know, now he's playing shortstop, and the first batter for Cincinnati that he's got to face is Eric Davis, who, of course, hits a ground ball right to him. So you're on the national stage, the world stage, and you've got to make that play. So fortunately for Bordick, he made a very routine play and got Davis out, and thus really got his major league career going from there. Now, as the A's continue to change their team and evolve, the team, Bordick was able to get a regular role with the team, again, splitting duties at shortstop and second base. And then once Walt Weiss moved on, he basically held down the shortstop position through 1996 and did so very well. Now, he became a free agent after the 1996 season, didn't like the direction that the A's were going in after La Russa left, so he signs with the Baltimore Orioles, and Pat Gillick, who is the GM of the Orioles at the time, says, you're going to be our next shortstop. We're moving Cal Ripken over to third base. And at first, Bordick is just floored by that idea. He's like, holy crap, I've got to follow a legend. So Gillick said, listen, whether you sign with us or not, we're going to make this move anyways. So Bordick is looking at the rest of the Orioles lineup, and it's very easy to forget how good the Orioles were in the mid to late 90s. They had the opportunity to be a dynamic team. The downside was they were in the same division as the Yankees, who did turn into a dynasty at that time. And you've had so many Oriole and Yankee clashes. Of course, the Indians had a damn good team at that time too. So the Indians and Orioles would often meet up in the playoffs in the early rounds. And it was either the Yankees or the Indians who would move on to the World Series. The Orioles always got eliminated. So he's looking at this team as a great opportunity. He says, absolutely, I'm going to, you know, play for this team. And, you know, he conferred with Ripken, made sure it was good that he was moving into this position. And he would be a very solid shortstop for the Orioles for parts of the next four seasons. Now, the Orioles start declining and start blowing up the team in 2000. So he is traded to the Mets, who are on a World Series run in 2000. And he was part of the Subway Series for the Mets. And it was a very fortuitous timing for him as well, because the Mets were looking for a shortstop, much like how Bordick got into the big leagues with or a consistent regular role in the big leagues with the injury to Walt Weiss during the playoffs. Well, now he gets called into the 2000 playoff race because of injuries that the Mets were having at that time. So he just seems to find himself in the right place at the right time all throughout his entire career here, but good for him. So the Mets have some injuries. He gets traded to the Mets. He's part of that World Series run, and of course, the Yankees win there. So a little bit of a tough luck situation for Bordick. You know, 1990, you get swept by the Reds. 2000, you lose to the Mets. All those years in between with Baltimore, so many good teams, but just not good enough as the Yankees or the Indians. So he came very close numerous times, but not quite close enough to eventually getting that World Series championship. Now, all throughout this time, while playing with Baltimore and the Mets, he is setting major league records for his defense. He would set the record for most consecutive errorless games and chances by a shortstop. He was an all-star in 2000, and as I mentioned, that was with Baltimore, but then after Ray Ordonez got hurt for the Mets, he ends up with New York in a trade for Melvin Mora. That kind of worked out for both sides, I would have to say. But his defensive prowess is often overlooked because there were just so many other shortstops at the time. Of course, Derek Jeter is becoming a dominant force at that position. You also had Alex Rodriguez in Seattle. You had Nomar in Boston at the time. And of course, with the Yankee-Red Sox rivalry, really really heating up in the mid to late 90s. Often, Bordick, whether he was in Oakland or Baltimore or with the Mets, just got overseen. Now, after the 2000 season, he signs with the Orioles once again, although the team is teetering a little bit, and his career is starting to wind down as well. He played two full seasons in Baltimore, played a final season, 2003, in Toronto, where J.P. Ricciardi, the GM, former Oakland Athletics scout who signed him back in 1986, gives him an opportunity, and he would end his career there. Not known for his hitting, although he was a pretty steady, consistent hitter with a .260 career average, 626 RBI, as I mentioned. His defensive game is something that definitely carried him. And again, a lot of people have overlooked his defensive game and his career because there were just so many other either big name shortstops or shortstops in bigger name markets, i.e. Boston and New York, that kind of overshadowed everything he was doing in Oakland and later Baltimore. And he only played 56 games for the Mets, not including postseason. So he just got a little brief time with that experience in the media with New York. And of course, the Mets had far bigger stars than that team: Robin Ventura, Mike Piazza, Al Leiter, a whole lot of other cast of characters that kind of overshadowed what Bordick was doing. But he was very consistent and did a solid job there. Now, as his playing career wound down, he ended up being a roving minor league instructor for, you guessed it, the Blue Jays, J.P. Ricciardi helping him out. And it's not a coincidence that once Ricciardi got let go after the 2009 season, Bordick would also move on. In 2010, he heads back to Baltimore, is a minor league offensive coordinator, and also a temporary bullpen coach as the Orioles were changing things up in 2011. He then got into the broadcast booth in 2012, being a color analyst, splitting time with Jim Palmer on Masson, and he was part of the just total disintegration, the pulling apart of the Masson broadcast. Not just TV, radio was affected as well. They blew out a lot of their announcers and studio hosts, the Orioles did prior to this season. And he left that. But he is still very much entrenched in the Baltimore community and is also still very much involved with a charity called League of Dreams, which helps children with disabilities play baseball and softball. Great thing for him to be involved with still to this very day. So I should mention, too, he has been recognized as a member of the Baltimore Orioles Hall of Fame. So despite having a .982 save percentage for his career at every infield position that he played in, Mike Bordick, amazingly, not a Gold Glove winner. And that, again, really is a testament to just some of the more ballyhooed names, more well-known names or players in more well-known markets who did get that honor. Now, from a player who didn't get the hardware for his solid play to a player who did, well, at least once, but it was certainly well-deserved, and in fact, very briefly, a teammate of Mike Bordick's in Baltimore, although you probably don't remember that. We have Doug Drabeck here. Douglas Dean Drabeck. Boy, the family loved the D's there. Native of Victoria, Texas, near the Houston area. He was born in Victoria, went to school in Victoria as well, St. Joseph High School. He was also a football player there as well. He was actually drafted by the Cleveland Indians in 1980 in the fourth round, didn't sign, opted to go to the University of Houston, and was a star pitcher for the Cougars baseball team. The Chicago White Sox would then draft him following his junior year at Houston in the 11th round of the 1983 draft, and that time he did sign. Now, he goes into the White Sox farm system and is doing very well as a minor leaguer. Pretty impressive short season New York Penn League. Also, Double-A in his second season, going 12-5, 2.24 earned run average with Glens Falls. He was then traded in August of 1984 to the New York Yankees alongside Kevin Hickey to complete a deal that was done earlier that season for Roy Smalley. So now he's in the Yankee farm system, spends the rest of the 84th season at AA Nashville, gets promoted to Albany Colony late in the 1985 season, and starts the 1986 season at AAA in Columbus, but would make his major league debut in relief in May of 1986 following Joe Niekro, who started a game and got rocked pretty early. Now, he would appear in 27 games, got 21 starts with the Yankees, going 7-8, a 4.10 earned run average. You know, some decent numbers, but if you're the Yankees, you're looking at this guy, he's 25 years old, and he's just kind of, with his stats, you're thinking, okay, we'll pass, thanks. So they trade him, along with Logan Easley and Brian Fisher, to the Pittsburgh Pirates for Pat Clements, Rick Rodin, and one of the great names of 1980s baseball, Cecilio Guante. I always thought Cecilio Guante, his name just sounded like bat poop. It was just, what's your last name, son? Guante. What? Yeah, and that was one of those one-sided deals in the long term that did not work out for the Yankees. There are plenty of others in their history, even though they've had some one-sided deals go their way. Not so much in the case for Doug Drabeck. Now, Drabeck not getting lost in the Yankees farm system, but getting an opportunity to mature with an up-and-coming Pirates team under Jim Leland. And he would definitely flourish after a rather pedestrian first season with the Pirates, 1987, 11-12 record, but a 3.88 earned run average and a pretty good strikeout-to-walk ratio. I want to say 3-1 was the average at that time. And as the Pirates improve, so does Drabeck. Not only does the win total go up, but the earned run average comes way down. Remember 1986, he had a 4.10 his first season in the big leagues. Well, by 1990, 2.76 earned run average, still keeping that roughly 3-1 strikeout to walk ratio. And as the Pirates are piling up wins, now Drabeck is too. He led the National League in victories with 22 in 1990, also led the National League in win percentage as he went 22-6 in 33 starts. So all of those numbers, plus with the Pirates returning to the playoffs for the first time since 1979, culminates in Drabeck winning the National League Cy Young Award. In fact, he runs away with it. Second place in the voting was Ramon Martinez, a very distant second in that balloting. He actually, Drabeck, finished eighth in the MVP voting, so he really took the National League by storm. And, you know, much like those Orioles teams from the mid to late 90s are often forgotten about with how good of a team they had, same thing with the Pirates, and you're hearing a lot of people now that you're 30 years removed, they're looking back at those Pirates teams of 1990, 91, and 92. And yeah, you had Bonds and Bonilla, but you look at some of the other players that were involved in that team. You had Vance Slyke, you had Michael Avalle, you had Drabeck, you had, you know, John Smiley was an outstanding young pitcher for that team. A lot of talent on that Pirates team. And I know the Pirates have been in the playoffs a couple of times since then, but nothing, you know, even the teams that were in the playoffs just a few years ago, nothing close to just this consistent force in the National League East that the Pirates had at that time. And Drabeck was a big part of that. While the wins would get reduced and the losses went up a couple of notches in 91 and 92, earned run average still hanging around 3, and he was also a Cy Young Award candidate in 1992, finishing 5th in the voting. What's amazing is that Doug Drabeck was never an all-star during this time. So, you know, you're kind of befuddled by how good Mike Bordick is, and you almost forget about it. It's really amazing that Drabeck, who was without a doubt the number one guy in the Pittsburgh rotation, wasn't even voted into an all-star game during his time in Pittsburgh. Well, in 1992, the Pirates again falling short in the playoff run. They lose to the Atlanta Braves, the infamous Sid Bream hustle around the bases to score the game-winning run in Game 7 of the NLCS. dejected Barry Bonds sitting in left field. We all remember that. Well, the Pirates, at that point in time, they decide to go in cheap mode. They slash and burn the payroll. Bonds walks. He goes and signs with the San Francisco Giants. Other players are on the move. And what do you know? So is Doug Drabeck. He signs a free agent deal with the Houston Astros, goes back home, and has a pretty productive season in 1993, a 3.79 earned run average. Again, strikeout to walk ratio is still working at about a 2.5 to 3 to 1 ratio, but the Astros in 1993 are very much still in rebuild mode. Now, they weren't as bad as they were a couple years ago, but guys like Jeff Bagwell and Craig Biggio and Luis Gonzalez, Curt Schilling, well, Schilling was with the Phillies by then, but a lot of the younger talent that the Astros had started pulling together over the previous couple of years, still coming together. So he would have Drabeck a 9-18 record, despite pretty good other numbers in the pitcher department. Now, he finally does get the All-Star nod in 1994. Ironically, the game played in Pittsburgh, and he had returned to All-Star status. 12-6 record, 2.84 earned run average. But of course, the strike shortened season. Drabeck could have had the season played out to its entirety, could have had a 20-win season, or at least come very close to it, but unfortunately, that was not the case. Unfortunately, also for Drabeck, all downhill from there. While the Astros are improving as a team, he individually is declining. His earned run average is ballooning up near 5 in 1995, 96, and by the end of the 1996 season, he and the Astros decide to part ways. He signs on with the Chicago White Sox in 1997, has a winning season going 12-11, but has a terrible earned run average. He's losing his control. In fact, what used to be a 3-1 strikeout to walk ratio now almost 1-1 at this point in time. He's also battling injuries and just ineffectiveness as well. As I mentioned, he was briefly a teammate with Mike Bordick in Baltimore in 1998, where he signed as a free agent. 21 starts, 23 appearances, a woeful 6-11 record, and just a god-awful earned run average of 7.29 in his time in Baltimore, and that would signal the end. Even though he bounced around a couple of spring training contracts and minor league opportunities along the way, was never able to make it to the big league. So after an outstanding start, especially that 1990 season, really struggled in the mid-90s with his career ending in 1998. Now, he would become an impactful a Little League coach, helping his son, Kyle Drabeck. We know what happened with him. He turned out to be a pretty decent player for several seasons earlier in the past decade. But he would coach Kyle's son coached Kyle's team and helped his son and his team succeed beyond wildest expectations then. And after a couple of years of helping coach his son, Doug Drabeck was able to get back into the major leagues as a coach, first as a pitching coach for the Yakima Bears in 2010, a farm club of the Arizona Diamondbacks. He was then promoted to the pitching coach for Class A Visalia, and he has since moved up the chain. Double A Jackson Generals in 2018, he was their pitching coach, and he is currently a pitching coach for the Double A affiliate for the Diamondbacks, the Amarillo Sod Poodles, in one of the more clever named minor league teams that are around. As I mentioned, Kyle Drabeck spent 7 seasons as a starting pitcher with Arizona, Toronto, and the White Sox. And also, son Justin played several seasons in independent ball. He also has a daughter, Kelsey, born with his wife, Christy. So the family still very much involved in the whole baseball scene. And Doug Drabeck, again, kind of in that same boat as Mike Bordick, although Drabeck does have that Cy Young Award hardware. But just a guy who, it's amazing how dominant he was, the number one guy, arguably, in the pitching staff for the Pirates during the early 1990s, didn't even get an All-Star invite in all those years. It's kind of crazy when you think about it. Last but certainly not least, a player who is still a legend in Minnesota, even though he played for several other teams. We're talking about Dan Gladden. Boy, Dan Gladden was in the right place at the right time a couple of times with the Minnesota Twins. And here is a guy, too, who had a pretty serviceable career, 270 career batting average, could knock in runs, defensively was pretty good player, played mostly in the outfield. You could also use him as a designated hitter, had some pretty good defensive numbers, but also never got an all-star nod. Only once was in any kind of trophy talk. He finished fourth in the National League Rookie of the Year voting in 1984. Of course, Ryan Sandberg winning that. Other guys... not Ryan Sandberg. That was the MVP. Rookie of the Year was Dwight Gooden. He was pretty good. So, you know, when you had Dr. K as your number one rookie in 1984, it's pretty obvious. No matter how good of a season Dan Gladden could have had, he wasn't going to quite eclipse Gooden in that year. Dan Gladden, better known as Clinton Daniel Gladden III, a native of San Jose, California. Attended Cal State Fresno, signed by the San Francisco Giants as an amateur free agent in 1979, and would make his major league debut in the 1983 season with the Giants, September 5th, 1983. So a very quick rise for him from undrafted free agent in 1979 to playing for practically his home team in San Francisco. Now, he would play for the Giants for parts of four seasons, because he did have some minor league time in 83 and 84, but two full seasons in 85 and 86, some injuries sidelining him a little bit in 1986. And while the Giants are building up to a team that would eventually become a contender, Dan Gladden would get traded in the spring training of 1987 to the Minnesota Twins. So he's traded along with minor leaguer Dave Blakely to Minnesota for minor leaguer Jose Dominguez and Ray Velasquez. And then Brian Hickerson was the player to be named later in the trade. I would have to say the Minnesota Twins undoubtedly won that deal, because Brian Hickerson didn't even get to the big leagues until 1991. And in the end, in 5 years, he was a pitcher, by the way. He had a 21-21 record and wasn't really much of anything to write home about. So he comes into the Minnesota Twins and is given an opportunity to play in the outfield. Tom Kelly was able to work him into the lineup, kind of figure out where he fit in best. And the man known as the Dazzle Man, partially because of the incredible mullet that he had, was able to parlay that trade into a great opportunity, as even though he didn't shine with the bat so much in his first season, hitting just .249 in 1987, he came up with some big plays, first of all in the 87 World Series, and then later on in the 1991 World Series. Let's start with 1987. Game one, he would hit the first grand slam in a World Series game in 17 years. And then in 1991, he hit what was a bloop double, believe it or not. Yeah, there was game seven, that incredible game that we still talk about 30 years later, Jack Morris against John Smoltz, going back and forth for 10 innings. Well, eventually Smoltz gets pulled and Alejandro Pena is pitching for the Braves. And Gladden is able to, with a broken bat, line a ball into the outfield. Brian Hunter's playing left field. He can't play the carom right. So, Ron Gant's got to cover behind Hunter. And while this hilarity is happening out in the outfield, Gladden legs out a double, just beats the throw into second base. The Metrodome is going crazy because here you are, bottom of the 10th, nobody out, and he's got the leadoff double on, of all things, a broken bat. And then eventually the Braves would load the bases. Gene Larkin at the plate is able to wrap in the game-winning run, and the Twins would win their second World Series. And Dan Gladden had a big part in both of those World Championships. And a great story that Gladden shared recently. That broken bat, you know, everyone's celebrating, you know, they've just won the World Series, and they're, you know, after they celebrate at the stadium, they're all going around out in the town to celebrate, and it dawns on Gladden at like 5:30 in the morning. He's like, hey, I don't have that bat. Where's that bat? And somebody, I forget who, if it was a teammate or an equipment manager, says, you know, oh, we tossed it in a garbage can in the locker room. So Gladden's like, screw that, I want to go get that bat. So they went to the Metrodome and were able to talk their way through security. They find the garbage can. Sure enough, there's the broken bat, and Gladden retrieved it, and he still has it to this day. A great story there with Dan Gladden. That would be his last moment of glory with the Minnesota Twins. Talking about parlaying deals, well, he was able to parlay that deal with the Twins granting him free agency into a contract with the Detroit Tigers for $1 million a year. Not bad for a guy who at that time was 34 years old and was a little rusty in the outfield and was mostly used as a designated hitter at that point in time. Pretty good 1992 season for Gladden, where he hit .254. Unfortunately for him, the Tigers were declining at that time. They kind of peaked in 90 and 91, and then he would play out his contract with the Tigers in 1993, appearing in just 91 games, but hitting .267, as well as 13 home runs during that stretch. Now, after his major league career ended with the Detroit Tigers, he would go on and play in Japan for the Yomiuri Giants in 1994. He won a Japanese Series championship there as well. Now, he would retire from the game, three-time world champion, quite literally world champion, you know, two with the major leagues and then one in Japan. And he would then move on to scouting. He would return to the Twins organization as a scout, later moved on to Colorado, and then became a roving instructor for the San Francisco Giants. Now, after his time in coaching, he would head back to Minnesota, became the color commentator with the Twins radio broadcast starting in 2000 through 2006, and continues to provide commentary with Twins broadcast ever since then. Now, some interesting personal notes for Gladden. Like I said, he's part of the Twins broadcast, still lives in Minnesota, in fact, in Eden Prairie with his wife and two daughters. He's a big enthusiast of Harley-Davidson motorcycles. And here's a very interesting tidbit as well. Gladden's daughter, Ashley, married the son of former Twins teammate Gary Gaetti. So once a twin, always a twin, as you have the Gladden-Gaetti family ties going on there. But good for, you know, Dan Gladden, a free agent signing, and, you know, gets to play for his home team for a few seasons, gets traded to Minnesota. Of course, the Giants making some trades to bring in guys like Kevin Mitchell, some younger players in the outfield. But he's able to build that deal into two World Series championships, where he played a very important role in both, and then was able to get that last free agent contract out of Detroit, and then wins a championship in Japan. Crazy how that all works out there. So some memorable names, some that you may have forgotten how good they were, such as Mike Bordick, not winning any gold gloves, such as Dan Gladden, a guy who was ultimately in the right place at the right time numerous times in his career, and a guy like Doug Drabeck, who did get the hardware, but still often gets overshadowed by many of the more flame-throwing pitchers that were in the big leagues at that time. And a very similar thing could be said about 1992 OPG. A fine set, 196 cards, you know, or 198 cards rather, small set compared to others, loaded with stars, some good young players as well. And yeah, leans a little bit on the Canadian teams at that time, but a pretty solid design, pretty affordable now, because so many people have just kind of, you know, over the years just went, OPG, you know, they never really got into it. But it was a very nice pinnacle for OPG, not Pinnacle Brands, but for OPG, a nice little apex, if you will, after many, many years of mirroring what Topps was doing in the baseball cards, being able to eventually branch out on their own, put out a fine product, just one that, well, much like some of the players we talked about, got overshadowed by some bigger, flashier brands at that time. But again, if you've got a few bucks, maybe 30 bucks, you know, if you want to really splurge and go out and buy a couple boxes, you can very easily assemble this set. And especially if you're a collector of like Hall of Fame players, you know, if that's your niche, this is a set for it, because you've got so many, as we've discussed before, so many sets from the late 80s and early 90s where you just have that culmination of great veteran players at that time, young stars as well. This is an affordable way to get those if you're looking to add to your personal collection. Well, that'll do it for this view, not only of the history of OPG, the Canadian redheaded stepchild of the hobby, but also the 1992 OPG premiere set. Again, on deck, we'll pick out a set that we've only talked about once that we will revisit, one from the 1950s, one from the 1960s, one from the 1970s. So be on the lookout for those survey questions on our Twitter timeline at Wax and Gum Stains. And also, we will have some future shows with the Pacific Senior Professional Baseball League cards, also 1993 Fleer. And we'll try to work in an interview or two as well over our next few weeks. So glad to be back in the saddle, glad to be out here on the West Coast and settling in here, and glad to have you back as well. Don't forget, as we wrap up this podcast, we'll be back here in 2 weeks, our next program coming your way on Friday, July 30th via Audio Boom and all of the platforms that carry the program. And if you have not gotten vaccinated yet, get that COVID vaccine now. The numbers are showing the only people, or I shouldn't say the only, but the overwhelming majority of people who are getting COVID these days are the unvaccinated, and the people who are suffering the most are unvaccinated. The people who are getting hospitalized, the people who are dying, unvaccinated. Take it from somebody who did get the needles. I got the Pfizer versions. They work. The side effects were not that bad, and it is just so much easier to return to life as normally as possible without having to wear a mask everywhere and having to do a lot of the things we did before. So if you haven't done so, please do it. Help somebody, help keep others around you healthy, or be incredibly selfish and just do it for yourself. Just get her done, all right? I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for listening to Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next time